Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. First day of October. Time just really, really flies, though. But, you know, hopefully you have been cherishing every moment. And, you know, we want to make sure that we get you the most updated information that we can on a variety of topics. And I want you to, just like I said, you know, if you have a topic you want us to discuss, let us know on the G's Power Hour Facebook page, and we'll try to get somebody for it. This is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I think it's also Lung Disease Awareness Month, and we're going to try to talk about those topics as well. But anyway, the other topic that I wanted to discuss with you today, I think I mentioned that I was trying to get a professor on the show. In regards to a couple of things that I had discovered at the Florida Convention, Florida Realtors Convention. One is Red Tide, which we had an issue with, a very serious issue with, about a couple of years ago. Not this year, fortunately, but last year. Also, blue-green algae. And so there's a professor, Dr. Michael Parsons, from Florida Gulf Coast University. He's going to be joining us today. I'm checking to see if he is on yet, and no, he's not on yet, but we will get him on there today. So anyway, if you have something you want to discuss, the number is 516-387-1944. That is 516-387-1944. Anyway. Okay. All right. I hope you can hear me. I've heard a couple of beeps, so I'm not sure if I'm still on the air or not. But anyway, we want to discuss, like I said, the blue-green algae. One of the things that has happened, one of the things that occurred and I discovered in the session that I went to was how it affects not only the sea life, the marine life, but also if you live in certain areas or you, let's say, get your food from some of these areas, it can have a great impact. So we want to bring on Dr. Michael Parsons. Dr. Parsons is, like I said, a professor at Florida Gulf Coast University, and he's the director of what's called the Vester Field Station. He was appointed to the Blue-Green Algae Task Force by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis earlier this year, 2019. In addition to teaching courses on marine ecology, Dr. Parsons has built a successful research career, and he's received over $20 million of extramural funding to study harmful algae blooms and their impact on coastal ecosystems. Dr. Parsons, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good morning. Thank you so much for agreeing to interview with us today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, Gretchen. Thank you very much for having me.
So I saw you at the Florida Realtors Convention, and you and some of your other key colleagues had just a lot of information. And I guess for me, it was very impactful just for the simple reason I love the water. I love going to the beach. I love going to the ocean. We lived on a coastal area for a little while when I was a little girl. And so I know that, you know, one of the things that minimal things that used to happen to us when we lived on the coast is, you know, you got the sea spray, you know, further than you thought. And so there's always this coat of salt or whatever on the car or something you have to keep clean.
Right.
But there's so much more that goes on. Tell me, how did you get involved with the governor's task force, and what is it that he is needing your expertise on?
So when we had these blue-green algal blooms last year, I would be getting interviewed by various news outlets, and one question that was asked of me was by a woman who was 7 months pregnant, and she lived on a boat in the Fort Myers Yacht Basin, and it was surrounded by blue-green algae, and so everybody was concerned about the smell and the chemicals that were basically vaporizing or volatilizing off of these algal bloom mats. And it did smell pretty bad. And so her question was, you know, with all these odors and these chemicals that are being released, am I safe? Is my unborn child safe from these algal blooms? And, you know, so it was a question that kind of floored me and really, you know, put the gravity of the situation into context on, wow, this could be, you know, a big human health concern here. And so I did some snooping around and some research on looking through the literature, the scientific literature, and I made some phone calls to colleagues I knew that worked on red tide and how some of the red tide toxins could be airborne, and looked into some of the blue-green algal toxins and found that there was not a lot of data on the airborne nature of these toxins. And so so that led me to do some research on the airborne toxins. And we detected the toxins in the air, which other groups had done before. But we also used some instruments that would size fractionate the toxins and even fractionate it down to the smallest particles that would be capable of reaching deep down into your lungs, down into your air sacs. And so if toxins can make it all the way down into your alveoli, into your air sacs, that would provide a mechanism for those toxins to then get transferred into your bloodstream. And then that would be a route of exposure. So basically, my work showed that this was a vector. This was a potential risk for people that these airborne toxins could get deep into your lungs and then could get into your bloodstream. And so, of course, that generated a lot of interest and concern with the public. And you had to be careful in terms of presenting the data. A lot of people were scared and concerned, and you know, it's kind of a fine line between, you know, presenting your results and interpreting those results and keeping it in context in terms of, we don't know a lot about this, you know, but this is what the data suggests. It looks like it could be a vector, but we need to do more research. So I think a combination of the fact that we did some of those studies, the fact that I was speaking to the public a lot and keeping a measured approach, cautious approach, acknowledging their concerns, but also being able to communicate that we need to learn more. We're not sure exactly what this means yet, and really doing a nice job of conveying that message. I think those really led the governor and the Department of Environmental Protection to consider me to serve on this task force. And in terms of the expertise, that really then ties into the human health component of the task force.
So what I'd like to find out, just to kind of get people to understand a little bit more, because it is the blue-green algae, is it something, well, first of all, I want to ask, is this something that's more prone to happen in saltwater areas or freshwater areas? That's my first question.
So there are blue-green algae everywhere, but the blue-green algae that are really presenting problems, potential health risks to people and to wildlife, are freshwater blue-green algae. And they're even though they're common in basically all environments, and they're in the freshwater all the time, the problem is when they bloom. And they typically bloom when you have a lot of nutrients going into the water and when the waters are warm, so during the summer months, for example. So if you have a combination of high nutrients and warm water temperatures, those are conditions that can lead to blue-green algal blooms.
And you say nutrients, and for humans, for regularly, when we think of nutrients, that's usually a good thing, but in this case, it's not. It's different types of things that go into our water, like I would say, like fertilizers and other things. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. And so, just like anything, you know, anything in excess can be harmful. So nutrients are good. Algae need nutrients. Seagrasses need nutrients in the water, just like plants need nutrients on land. We need nutrition, so we need the nutrients when we eat food. But when you have too many nutrients going into the system and the system can't process them, that's when you start seeing some of these problems of excessive nutrients like blue-green algal blooms. And so depending on the water body of interest, how the nutrients get into that water body and the source of those nutrients will vary from place to place. So, for example, for Lake Okeechobee here in Florida, it's mainly fertilizer from agriculture use. You may look at another retention pond or a small pond in the neighborhood. Maybe in that case, it would be septic tanks. You may see a pond on a ranch, and in that case, it could be livestock and the production of manure. So there's going to be different nutrient sources depending on how the water drains, what the land use is, and then how the water drains into that water body.
So is this a problem primarily for people that live on, let's say, waterfront property, or how far does this go?
We know with the red tide toxins, they can be airborne for, you know, up to 5 miles or so, plus or minus a couple miles. It looks like from our preliminary data where we were away from any bloom and away from water bodies, it looks like it could be a couple miles away, but the levels of toxins that we measured were much lower than near the bloom. And so you do get a dispersion or a dilution effect as you move away from the bloom, as the winds kind of swirl and mix with other air that doesn't have the toxin in it. But again, a lot of these results are based on just studies we conducted earlier this year. And we've basically been in a holding pattern right now, waiting to see if another big algal bloom happens this year. And fortunately, we haven't seen a bloom happen this year. So we may need to go back out and just collect some more of this baseline non-bloom data just to get a sense of what are the everyday kind of baseline conditions. Do we see a low level of toxins in the air all the time, or is it really only during the bloom? And that really ties back then into who is most at risk. Probably the people that are on the water or near the water the most would be exposed to the toxin more frequently and maybe at higher concentrations. But we still need to get a handle on what those concentrations are and do they really present a real health risk or not. People are exposed to, you know, different compounds, different chemicals all over the place in the environment. And our liver and our enzymes do a good job of removing those toxins and preventing damaging effects to people. But again, if you're exposed a lot and there's high doses, it can basically overrun our natural defenses. So that's where the concerns can come into play. And we just need to gather more data on that to really understand it.
Does the heat or any type of weather conditions, do they does that play a role in terms of the development of these blooms?
So in addition to warmer water temperatures, the blue-green algal blooms tend to like waters that are stagnant, waters that are basically just sitting there and they're not mixing, they're not flushing. And there's just something about the water almost aging and just getting stagnant. And I think part of the reason, and I guess part of the reason why the blue-green algae like those stagnant water conditions. Number one, many of these blue-green algae have little air sacs in them, little air bubbles inside them, so they can float and they can stay suspended in the water even if there is no mixing or any flushing of the water. So that can give them an advantage where they can stay up, get all the light they need for photosynthesis and growth, and they can move around in the water column to find their ideal temperatures, ideal nutrient concentration, so on and so forth. And also, when the water is just sitting there, that gives other bacteria time to break down organic matter and to recycle nutrients and basically change the chemistry of the water that the blue-green algae seem to like better than other algae. So it's a combination of warm temperatures, aging that water, and then having that water basically sit really still and be stagnant for a while. And those tend to be a combination that can lead to the domination and the high biomasses of blue-green algae.
We are here with Dr. Michael Parsons. We are discussing a couple of key items that affect our water quality here in Florida. One is blue-green algae and the other is red tide. The number, if you have questions, is 516-387-1944. That is 516-387-1944. We're going to take a quick break. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Hi, I'm Tim Garrison. You may know me as Timmy G. Yeah, I know. It's been two decades, but I want you to know I'm back in the Arglicex. And I've got a mix of music that can help you relax and chill out. It's smooth. It's relaxing. It's chill out jazz. The soulful mix of smooth jazz, soul, and smooth R&B. So join me every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. to midnight, on K-Ham Radio.
Are you chilling?
A wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar, or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Hi,
I'm Gretchen Depp Simmons with Feral Realty, but you know me as G from G's Power Hour. Much of the time when I'm not engaging with you on my show, I'm dealing in real estate in beautiful Central Florida. But because I'm here, that doesn't mean I can't help you wherever you are. So if you're looking to buy, invest, relocate, rent, or sell, please give me a call at 407-968-9387. That's 407-968-9387, and let me help you with your real estate needs.
Good morning. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're here with Dr. Michael Parsons, who's a professor of marine science at the Water School at Florida Gulf Coast University. He's also the director of the Vester Field Station and was appointed to the Blue-Green Algae Task Force by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And I wanted to ask you about using, if you are a person in an avid fishermen here in Florida. And I know you talked about Lake Okeechobee, but we also have Lake Apopka in Central Florida, which is, you know, the big body of water here. But no matter what the body of water, if you are a person that fishes and you like to fresh caught seafood from these bodies of water, is there a concern?
It depends on what type of seafood you're looking at and what kind of algae that we're talking about. So if you're looking into the blue-green algae, the data that have been collected to date suggests that the fish fillets themselves really are not accumulating the toxins. There's a low level that they see in there, but it's definitely a level that your body can process and is below any of the guidances that have been issued. But it's similar to mercury, and where they say, you know, you shouldn't eat, or you should only eat so much swordfish, or you should only eat so much tuna. So when you're being exposed to these blooms, or when you're fishing waters near these blue-green algal blooms, you should probably just be careful and maybe not fish or catch the fish right where an active bloom is happening. And don't be eating a lot of fish. So don't be eating fish, you know, maybe more than once a week or whatnot. The other thing that's of concern would be most of the toxins will accumulate in the viscera, so in the guts, in the liver of the fish and shellfish as well. And so you'll want to avoid eating them. And so for some people, they may say, well, yeah, I don't eat the guts of fish. But, you know, if you eat like a whole sardine or a whole anchovy, you know, bay anchovies and things like that can move up into waters that will have blue-green algal blooms in them. So you should be careful about, you know, eating a whole fish or eating the viscera of fish. Some people will eat mullet. They'll eat the viscera of the mullet as well. Another thing to be careful of is if you're catching blue crabs or other shellfish, because they can also accumulate the toxins. So anything from clams and oysters, you should avoid definitely during a bloom. But with crabs, you're not going to get it in Lake Apopka or in Lake O. But if you're in the estuaries downstream, especially of Lake O, and you're catching blue crabs, you should exhibit care, practice care not to eat basically the hepatopancreas, which is either the mustard, some people call it mustard, or they might call it the guacamole, because that also is where the toxins would be processed. So I think it's a combination of just don't eat a lot, avoid areas where there's an active bloom, and be careful about eating the viscera of various species.
Is there any way to tell if you've been, as far as you know, I know, like you say, some of these studies are still early, but is there any way to tell that you may have been exposed to this through any seafood that you may have been eating?
Well, generally from eating seafood, just like other kinds of seafood poisoning, you may feel nauseous. And so, and maybe, you know, maybe you'll get sick, could be diarrhea, could be vomiting, but those are usually the signs that you would see if you're being exposed to some of these blue-green algal toxins. With some some other ways that people are exposed to the toxins is in the water. So if you're if you're swimming in the water, if you're jet skiing through a bloom and you fall in the water, sometimes you might get a rash. And so some other toxic chemicals besides things like microcystins that are more of a toxin that we're concerned with, they can cause rashes and maybe some itchiness and things like that on your skin. Some people have reported flu-like symptoms. That might be more a combination of some of the chemicals that cause odors, like hydrogen sulfide. And when you're exposed to hydrogen sulfide at high enough doses, it can make you nauseous and feel sick. So you have to be careful in terms of if you have symptoms or you don't feel right after eating seafood or maybe being around a blue-green algal bloom, you can't necessarily pinpoint it on the blue-green algal bloom. There could be another factor that wasn't considered. And on top of that, you can't necessarily say it's one toxin or one chemical. You know, it could be something that's completely non-toxic, or it could be a combination of chemicals. So it gets pretty complicated. And so from an epidemiological point of view, a lot of times if there's an event and the epidemiologists need to basically figure out why people are getting sick, they'll just start comparing symptoms and look at maybe similarities of exposure. So if people all have coughs and they have a rash and they all ate catfish or something like that, well, maybe there's a common thread there of exposure. So it's hard to say really if any one exposure route has resulted in people, you know, basically getting sick. Any consistent number of people that we could actually target or pinpoint if there was an exposure that resulted in these symptoms.
So what can we do? I know you said there's certain other factors that are involved in terms of whether or not the water is stagnant or whether or not, you know, depending on the heat and some other things. But in terms of our contribution to the environment, what types of things can we do or not do to keep this incident from occurring or occurring so often?
I think the big thing is nutrients. And so the two things that people can do in terms of nutrients is consider what their nutrient footprint is in the environment. So are you using fertilizer for your lawn and your garden? Is your HOA using fertilizer? Does your golf club use fertilizer? And if you say yes to those questions, you may want to have discussions with the parties and think about, do you need to use fertilizer? Do you need to use as much fertilizer as is being applied? Are there more environmentally friendly fertilizers? Another thing to consider would be there are different plants you could use in your gardens and in your lawn and potentially even golf courses that are more Florida friendly. So they don't require as much fertilizer or any fertilizer in some cases, and they don't have the same water requirements. So a lot of the native plants, for example. So you could consider switching over and using more native plants. The other thing that people can do at home, if they're on a septic tank, for example, would be to have your septic tank inspected to see if it is performing as optimally as possible. Now, septic tanks were not designed to remove nutrients. They were really designed to protect public health against bacteria and pathogens, and also to break down the organic matter, the waste, into the nutrients, but the nutrients are then leached out into the environment. But there are advanced septic systems that can remove the nutrients as well. So if people need to upgrade a septic tank or if they're looking to build a new house that has to be on a septic system, you may want to consider one of these advanced systems. Besides that, where people can do almost a grassroots movement, the other thing I think that would be important is really, you know, be in touch and in contact with your legislators and let them know that this is important to you and that you support different measures to help reduce nutrient inputs into the environment. And so it's the two ways to really do that would be, can you modify how fertilizers and how other nutrient sources, how much of those nutrients are being produced or generated or applied? And the second part would be, what are we doing to prevent those nutrients from getting into the water? Because it's easier to treat them and to manage them if we do it at the source rather than trying to deal with it once it's in Lake Okeechobee, for example. So it's a combination of what can you do at home and talking to your local legislators and other legislators around the state and support different measures that would help look at ways that we can reduce the sources of nutrients, number one, and number two, how we can reduce the nutrients from getting into our waters.
We are here with Dr. Michael Parsons, who is a marine science professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you, Dr. Parsons, about red tide versus blue-green algae, because I'm sure a lot of people are not quite sure in terms of how they're differentiated. So I'd like to ask you about that when we come back. This is G's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment, and we will be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Swiffer Sweeper cleans so completely, you'll never go back to your old broom again.
Now a song for Mary from a Mr. Broom.
New Swiffer Sweepers redesigned to clean corners, and it traps and locks 50% more dirt, dust, and hair than a broom. So go all the way clean. New Swiffer. Clean better or your money back. Guaranteed.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Here with Dr. Michael Parsons, who is a professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Parsons, about what is the difference between blue-green algae and red tide, and how the impact of either one of them is one more harmful than the other to our marine life and to us.
Right. So there are many differences between the organism that causes Florida red tide and blue-green algae. So it's almost like comparing, let's say, an orange tree to a seaweed, if you will, like sargassum that washes up on the beach. So even though red tide and blue-green algae, they're both called algae and they photosynthesize, they're completely different organisms. One's a bacteria and one is a microscopic dinoflagellate, which is, in a scientific term, we would say it's a eukaryote. And so it has a nucleus and things like that. So they're basically in different kingdoms, if you all remember how we would classify plants and animals and life into, bacterial kingdoms and animal kingdoms, so on and so forth. So they're very different in that sense. From a practical sense, red tide is a marine organism. It lives in the ocean. It will not grow if the water has too much fresh water in it. And so that typically is around a salinity of 24, which is basically two parts ocean water and one part fresh water. So if you add more fresh water, they won't grow. Now, on the other hand, when you look at blue-green algae, they're freshwater, and they won't grow, generally speaking, if it's about half freshwater and half saltwater. And so they can survive as you get more salt in the water, but they'll end up dying by the time they get into the Gulf, for example, or into the Atlantic Ocean on the East Coast. So if red tide is being transported, let's say it is going upriver in the tides and things like that, it will die as the waters get fresher and fresher. Whereas blue-green algae, as it moves downriver and gets out to the ocean, it will die because it gets too salty. But there is potentially a zone where both could survive, where there's just enough salt for the red tide, but it's still fresh enough for the blue-green algae. So the real take-home message there is blue-green algae is fresh water and red tide is salt water. In terms of different health exposures and health risks, red tide really causes more wildlife mortalities than blue-green algae. And so if you just look at this past year with all of the blue crabs, all of the sea turtles, whale shark, all of the fish that died, dolphins, so on and so forth, you know, it was in the thousands to tens of thousands of organisms that were killed by the red tide. If you look at blue-green algae, you can get mortalities of birds, you know, any birds that would eat the algae. There were, unfortunately, pet mortalities this year. So we had, I think, 7 pets that died over on the East Coast in Fort Pierce and St. Lucie and along the Indian River Lagoon this past year. So people need to be aware that if your pets are near the water's edge where there's a blue-green algae, they could be exposed and harmed as well. And the CDC actually has a webpage on what to do if you think your pet has been exposed to these blue-green algae. In terms of people, we do a really good job of regulating and monitoring for red tide. And so in terms of oysters and clams and scallops, we monitor our shellfish beds so we know people won't be exposed to red tide toxins through shellfish, for example. And so when you buy Florida shellfish from the store and from vendors, you know those shellfish are going to be safe to eat and they won't have red tide in them. And that's important to know because shellfish will filter those red tide cells out of the water. And so they can accumulate a lot of toxin. And so when that happens, those shellfish beds are shut down until they flush out those toxins out of their system. If you look at blue-green algae, we don't have the same regulations in place. We're still learning about the different ways people can be exposed to the toxins, either by swimming and skin contact, like I briefly talked about, the airborne toxins we're still learning more about, and through ingestion. So that could be through seafood or through accidental drinking of lake water, let's say, that has the toxins in it. Our drinking water is safe. We can treat drinking water pretty easily to remove any of the toxins from the water using carbon filtration and ozone and things like that. So that being said, then, I think people are probably more at risk for blue-green algal toxins right now, if for no other reason, we just monitor the red tide toxins and know more about them. But when you look at the toxins, the blue-green algal toxins are probably more of a concern on top of that. So things like microcystins, they can cause liver damage. And so that's one of the main modes of action and one of the bigger concerns for long-term exposure or for acute short-dose exposures. Like if you, you know, I don't know, if you accidentally ate a big, you know, pile of pond scum or something like that that had the toxins in them, that could be pretty damaging to you. But there's other toxins produced by blue-green algae that, in a similar sense, if you were, you know, really eating the algae, which no one does really, or, you know, I wouldn't recommend it for sure, we're still learning about the other exposure routes of some of these other toxins, primarily through the water and just being exposed during recreational activities. So probably the toxins are more potent in blue-green algae, and we need to learn more about the routes of exposure in order to really assess the risk of them to the public.
One of the things when you were talking to the realtors several weeks back is you talked about how some of these things suck up some of the oxygen out of certain pockets of the water and cause some of the marine life to either float on top of the water or find things to float on to avoid those particular pockets. Could you explain a little bit about that?
So another way that both red tide and blue-green algae can be damaging to the environment and basically pose a risk to wildlife is that when you have these blooms, they can actually consume the oxygen in the water, especially at nighttime when there's no sunlight, so they can't photosynthesize and produce oxygen. So at nighttime, they're metabolizing, respiring, just like we do, and they need oxygen to do that. And there can be so many of them in the water, they can actually consume the oxygen overnight. And then there won't be enough oxygen left for crabs or for fish, so on and so forth. And so in that case, the fish and the crabs have to try to leave and move to areas where there's enough oxygen. If it's a small pond or a lake, let's say in the case of blue-green algae, there may be no place to go. And so you may get a fish kill in a pond or a lake that way, or in a canal if they can't get out of the canal. Out in the ocean, as I talked about when I was presenting for the Florida Realtors Group, you know, we were seeing the crabs, the blue crabs that could swim. They would swim up to the surface waters, and they'd be climbing up on dead fish and seaweed and things like that, probably resting because they were swimming for a long time. But there was no oxygen down in the water, so they were basically trying to get up near the water surface in the hopes that they could get more oxygen. And when we measured the oxygen in the water, there was enough oxygen for them to use, maybe in the upper 10 feet of the water column, but below 10 feet down to the bottom, which was, I think we measured down to about 60 feet, there was not enough oxygen in the water for them to basically breathe. There wasn't enough oxygen to pass through their gills and get into their bloodstream. The other part for red tide was that you also had a lot of dead biomass, a lot of dead fish and maybe dead crabs, dead sponges on the seafloor. And so the bacteria would break down that dead biomass and they would then consume the oxygen as well. So basically when you have a lot of biomass, either blooms or dead organic material, you can get high oxygen demand. We call that biological oxygen demand. That would draw down the oxygen levels, and then fish, crabs, other organisms may not have enough oxygen to breathe. And if they can't get out of the area, they'll end up dying.
Wow.
Yeah, just a nice little side effect from this. So.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, so what are, I guess, the goals from the task force now that you're on it? And how many people are on the task force? What are they bringing to the table in terms of different types of backgrounds? We know about you, but what's expected from this task force?
Basically, we have two tasks, and one of them is to offer recommendations to reduce nutrient inputs, not only into Lake Okeechobee, but in the state waters in general. And the second part is to, in addition to reducing nutrients, what other technologies, techniques, applications are there that we can recommend to help combat blue-green algal blooms, either the prevention of the blooms or to help mitigate and remove the blooms once they happen. And so part of that is basically working with the Department of Environmental Protection and Chief Scientist Tom Frazier on how we can learn about the different technologies that are out there, either established companies or maybe some new ideas people have, how we can become aware of those different technologies, different methods, how we can basically compare them and municipalities compare them, so we can do an apples-apples type comparison. So, for example, there might be some techniques that use chemicals like hydrogen peroxide. There may be other techniques that are physical, where they actually remove the algal biomass. There may be other techniques that are biological, where they'll introduce or promote the growth of bacteria that would compete against the cyanobacteria. So there's a lot of different techniques that have been proposed out there. So it's a sense of putting them all in one place, finding a way where we can compare them, see which ones are more effective, look at their performance, get a better grasp of their costs, look at their costs and their benefits, and just trying to build a good framework or a good rubric that we can basically look at these different methodologies, not only for algal removal and algal mitigation, but also for nutrient removal. And so it's basically two tasks, really, looking at nutrient reduction, what we can do to reduce nutrients, and looking at technologies that may help us remove nutrients and address the blue-green algal problems.
We are here with Dr. Michael Parsons. We're talking about the impact of blue-green algae and red tide. When we come back, I want to ask you, Dr. Parsons, about is this something that's unique to Florida, or are there other areas? So if you have questions for Dr. Parsons, the number is 516-387-1944. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720, Dobbs. Dedicated to serving our families.
Hi, welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're here with Dr. Michael Parsons of Florida Gulf Coast University. And Dr. Parsons, is this unique to Florida, or are there other areas of the country or around the world that are having this issue?
Basically, all over the world, there are examples of people dealing with big blue-green algal blooms. Probably in the United States, the best known, unfortunately, was Western Lake Erie and Toledo. And they were having blue-green algal blooms, Microcystis aeruginosa, the same one that we were dealing with last year in Lake Okeechobee. And it basically shut down their municipal water source. And so they didn't have safe drinking water. And so they had to bring in bottled water, and the National Guard was involved, so on and so forth. And so it was, really brought blue-green algal blooms to the forefront nationally, not just for Ohio. But California deals with them, with their reservoirs, because, again, a reservoir under certain conditions can be, almost a stagnant body of water, which can help promote blue-green algal blooms. Australia, in a similar sense, with their reservoirs, they've dealt with blue-green algal blooms. China has big, big issues with it. Europe, there were cases of wildlife and pet mortalities in New York State this summer. So probably in every state, you'll have at least a couple of examples of chronic and or, large acute type events of cyanobacteria, blue-green algal blooms that will be similar to what we saw in Florida, maybe on different scales, but you can find similar experiences or similar events elsewhere.
Yeah, one of the things you just mentioned has always been a concern to me about when they build these subdivisions and they put these retention ponds here. And I understand the need for some of that, but then you do have, in a lot of cases, these stagnant bodies of water. You're drawing things like mosquitoes and some other things, but having a lot of those around the area, I'm sure does cause some concern.
Well, it's something that's needed. We do need the retention ponds because when they're designed properly, they will actually accumulate a lot of the runoff, and then the system can process and basically remove the nutrients and help filter the water, so then the water can percolate out and be released in the environment. The problem is with some of these retention ponds is that because of fertilizers being input, because of irrigation or maybe unexpected rainfall events, they basically get overwhelmed. So they become less effective over time. And so then, you know, that's something that probably needs to be addressed, is what do we do with retention ponds that are not performing as well as they used to? Are there technologies we could use to basically remove some of the nutrients, remove organic matter, help clean the ponds so they become more effective? Are there technologies we can use to help flush the ponds better, so then you don't have that stagnation problem? You don't have to worry about mosquitoes as much, so on and so forth. So that's definitely something, you know, that we actually discussed this past week at our Naples task force meeting, was with stormwater retention and stormwater runoff. And if we talk about retention ponds as part of those components, you know, how do we know if they're working or not working? And how do we know if something needs to be done? Are they a potential problem in terms of nutrient inputs or in terms of blue-green algal blooms? And so, you know, if you see a blue-green algal bloom on a retention pond, that's a symptom that the pond is not working as effectively as it was designed to. And so how should we address that, you know, becomes the next question. And so that's, you know, that's something that the task force was introduced to at this past meeting. But, you know, in future meetings, we'll start getting into a higher level of detail and higher level of granularity on some of these issues, in terms of better understanding what the problem is and what are some of the solutions that are being discussed both by the state and by either HOAs or private industry. And is there an easy path or a clear path, not necessarily easy, that could be taken to address some of these issues?
I want to go back to two things that you mentioned. One was the fertilizers and everything. Does it make a difference if you use, let's say, organic products versus other types of fertilizers?
It partially depends on where the organic fertilizers came from.
Okay.
And so what I mean by that is, on one hand, if you're basically recycling organic matter, you're kind of using the nutrients that are already in the system. So that won't necessarily enrich, but if it wasn't from that system and you're actually importing this organic matter from elsewhere, you'll still be enriching the nutrients in your area or in your watershed. The other part of it would be when you look at those organic fertilizers, and it varies from, you know, the inorganics to the organics, in terms of what is actually being assimilated into the plants, what is being lost to runoff or lost into the water bodies, how are bacteria breaking it down, is it being utilized in the water? So some of that has to do with, is it the, you know, is it the source nutrient like phosphate or nitrate, or it being organic, are those compounds attached to a larger organic molecule, and so that would affect how quickly they're being utilized, how quickly they're being broken down. And when you say it's attached to another organic molecule, that molecule could be almost anything. And so it can create a level of complication when you try to follow that compound through the system to see if it's more effective or not. But, you know, in there are data available. And again, if you look at some of the work, for example, that the Department of Agriculture has done with their best management practices, and if you look at what University of Florida has done, especially with their Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, IFAS, they've looked at a lot of these different fertilizer compounds. And I mentioned before native plants, and mm-hmm. they know which ones work best in certain soils in the different areas around Florida. So a lot of that information is out there where you can see what would be best suited for your yard, for your gardens, you know, for your neighborhood, for your golf courses, so on and so forth.
And then my second question was about you talking about contacting your legislators. What should we ask them to do? Are there any specific things that we should be asking them to do?
I think right now, I know last year for Southwest Florida, a lot of it was really just saying, you know, we think water quality is the biggest issue in our district. And so we would like for you to support and concentrate on water quality issues. Right now, the legislature, as you know, is in committee. So they're starting to talk about some of the different bills and some of the different topics and items that they want to discuss and you know, bring up before the full legislature when they're in session. And so those different ideas, I'm not a legislator, so I don't know a legislator, so I'm not exactly sure, but, you know, those different ideas end up getting drafted into bills and then combined and edited, so on and so forth. So I think in the beginning, you're starting kind of in an embryonic sense. So are you interested in biosolids, for example? There's been a lot of interest in biosolids being a nutrient source in the St. John River area and, you know, how they're being applied and treated, so on and so forth. So if that's an issue of concern for you, make sure your legislators are aware of that. If you think fertilizer is one of your big issues or septic tanks, you can start with one of those topics and then see how bills are being drafted. And then, you know, then you can start saying, I'm in favor of bill, you know, SF4719-30 or whatever. That's not really a bill. I'm just making up a number. But as the process gets more refined and they hone in on the actual bills and the funding, so on and so forth, and what they'll vote on, you'll see it get more concise in that. But as a early start, it would be, you know, if you're interested in water quality and you're worried about the nutrient inputs. And so some of that might be just a general statewide concern. Some of it might be an Everglades concern. But in your district, maybe you have a very specific nutrient source. You know, in some areas, it's going to be fertilizer. In other areas, it's going to be septic tanks. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. All around Florida, there's going to be different nutrient sources that if nutrient reduction is or excessive nutrients are causing water quality issues in your district or in your local watershed, then you'll have one of these specific nutrient sources that could be something to discuss with your local legislators. And
Dr. Parsons, thank you. Dr. Michael Parsons from Florida Gulf Coast University. It was good for you to take time out and clarify a lot of this for us. Really appreciate it.
Sure, you're welcome. And enjoyable.
Have a blessed day now.
Okay, you too.
And thank you all for joining us. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Have a very blessed day. Talk with you tomorrow. And please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care. Oh,
Get up on your feet in here. Here we go. Come on.